great to see you again here this morning. So this is our last week, and I want to say thank you so much that you all have been here. I'll tell you my secret thing each week when I've gotten up here is, like, you guys keep showing back up. I'm so thankful for that. You know, I try to really be mindful. This is not the most exciting topic, and we talked about those. Most marriages have one spouse that likes this topic, and the other spouse is like, oh, you got to be kidding me, finances, what is going on here? So I try to always remember that reluctant spouse and remember this is not the most wonderful topic in the world. So anyway, we're coming to our conclusion. So thank you all for continuing to show up here every week. I've enjoyed that. I want to say thank you to Jim and Rosie Blanchard for their help each week getting the materials reproduced. And I want to thank the sound guys in the back for their help in getting set up, and the ushers who've handed out the handouts every week, and then also for Pastor Mazak for making this opportunity available. It has really been a joy to be with you. You've got a warm, wonderful congregation. I can see why you're so excited about your church, and you have every reason to feel that way. It's really been a joy to get to know you. Well, one of the things that dawned on me, and if you want to, maybe grab your handout and look at the little checklist that's attached. It's kind of as an appendix here this week and kind of a summary of all the places we've been this summer. It dawned on me as I was preparing this week that one of the things we haven't done, and again, we've got the checklist up here, and you've seen it now throughout the summer, and we've kind of used that to keep track of where we were going. But one of the things that dawned on me, Pastor Mazak, is we really haven't told everybody how not to use their money. Kind of an oversight on my part. Several things we haven't, you know, we haven't said of what not to do with your money. So I thought we might want to take a minute and think about some things we shouldn't do with our money. So I think we could all agree that that would be a terrible use of your money. So I think we'd have universal agreement there. And so hopefully you would not ever commit that mistake there. Another thing you probably would never want to spend money on, I would think you'd certainly never want to spend your money there. That would be terrible. And just so you know, I can take a joke as well. You probably should never want to own a car like this, a little 2008 Infiniti. You would never want to do that. That would be a terrible use of your money. So anyway, so I want to clear that up and get that out of the way here this morning.
We're glad this is your last week.
You notice we didn't pick on your truck. We're okay with the truck. We like the fact you have a truck. Okay, well, if you have your handout in front of you, you may look at it for a second and say, Jeff, boy, that is a pretty intimidating list of things that you want us to do. Like, man, that's a lot of work, and that's going to really take a lot of discipline. And frankly, and you know it's kind of progressive as we go through life. I know some of you in those early Sundays probably wondered if I was ever going to quit talking to those folks in their 20s, you know, because there were so many things we were wanting them to kind of get established as 20-something couples. And then as we got farther down the checklist, of course, we started talking about retirement planning and talking to people my age and above. And so one of the things I want to reassure you with as you look at a long checklist like this is that it really is a lifetime plan, and you see in your box there on the front of the handout, it's a lifetime plan. But the other big encouragement I want to remind us of is that even if you have aced all 16 of these things, and I have no doubt that there are people here that would say, Jeff, listen, you're still an amateur at this game. I've been doing finances, and I've been on a ministry salary for literally decades, and I've heard stories in the lobby from you, and I know you all are literally role models in this, and you've done it on a level I know nothing about. I mean, frankly, I've been paid a business person's salary most of my life, so I haven't made sacrifices and done without the way many of you all here have. So some of you would say, look, I've done all 16 of these things, and I'm doing them as a habit of life. That's just my character of life. And all I would say is, let's just remember that our security is not in our plan. We're going to end the lesson here today with somebody whose plan completely unraveled at the end of life, somebody that really did face a financial apocalypse at the end of life, and so we don't put our confidence in our plan. You know, you say, well, I've done this series, or I've been through that book, or I've done this workbook, and I know I'm right on this thing. Well, just remember, you know, for a lot of us, 08 and 09 was a good reminder that we don't trust in our plan. You know, that was quite a moment for most of us my age that, wow, you look at a lifetime's worth of savings and you see the market go down 57%, and you go, wow, this is quite a moment here. This is quite a test of whether I believe in my plan or whether I know that victory does belong to the Lord. A couple other thoughts for you to kind of, again, reassure you on this thing. If you are in ministry and you say, Jeff, it's just not in the cards for me to pay my home off early. I mean, it's just not going to happen. There's just too many expenses, and we're barely making ends meet. I totally hear you 100%, and I would say go as far as you can on the right road. You know, no harm if you can't get to the end of that road. There are people in secular work that won't completely get there either, but go as far as you can on the right road. Second of all, sometimes we do get an unexpected financial windfall. It may not seem that way. You know, it may seem like the only unexpected thing is more expenses, you know, even more repairs, even more, car accidents or whatever it might be. But we really do occasionally get the unexpected windfall. And if you get that, look at it as a way to make an advance on that plan. You know, make it a way to say, well, maybe this is how I'm going to get my 3 to 6 months of savings in the bank, or maybe this is a way I can really make a dent on my house payment or whatever. So look at that unexpected windfall as a way to advance yourself down that checklist. And then, of course, I told you that sometimes it's okay to break the rules. You know, in my family, we as a couple, my wife and I, were much more excited about debt repayment than we were about accumulating a savings account in the bank. I mean, that just wasn't real motivating for us. We weren't, frankly, that good at savings. That just wasn't our strength. But we were pretty good, and my wife more so than me in the early days, and then it became my conviction as well. We became pretty obsessed about trying to pay debt. And that was a really good thing. It really galvanized our marriage, and we did some things out of order. Of course, that order didn't exist either back when we were going along, you know, the 7 steps to financial peace or whatever. That was, a figment of Dave's imagination back in those days. So we didn't really have that to go by anyway. So a couple other thoughts here. Again, if you're working your way down this plan, it is a lifetime plan. Remember Galatians 6:9. Let us not lose heart. I love that phrase. That's a great phrase. Let us not lose heart in doing good, for in due time we will reap if we do not grow weary. And, of course, the analogy there is to sowing and planting a crop. And the crop doesn't come up any faster because you go out and check the field every day, right? I mean, it's going to take its time to come up, but we will have a harvest. We will reap if we don't faint. And then finally, one big message I would give you is don't sell yourself short. I taught this material back in from about 95 to 97. It was kind of the first time I taught it as a series. I kind of went around through the adult classes at our church. And if you had interviewed me at the end of some of those lessons, like particularly those lessons about paying your house off early, if you had pulled me aside and said, Jeff, are you really directing this at people that work at BJU or people that work at GFA or they're in a ministry setting? If you had interviewed me off to the side, I would have said, no, I'm really not aiming at them. I'm talking about people like me that are in the corporate world, or I was in public accounting for a while. I said, no, I would have really said, I'm not aiming it at those folks. I don't think they can pay their home off early. Well, I'm glad I never said any of that publicly, because you never know what the Holy Spirit is doing with this. And 20 years later, I've had several couples come to me at some of the most unexpected moments. I can remember a couple of these where they'll walk up just out of the clear blue 20 years later and go, hey, Jeff, we're 2 payments away from paying our house off. And I'm going, you got to be kidding. These are 2 people that have been in ministry all this time. It, you know, and then secretly I'm going, and I wasn't even really aiming at you. But somehow the Holy Spirit was aiming at them. They took that on as a personal goal. And here they were, and they were people, a lot of them my age, they were getting that done by age 50 or age 55. So what I'm saying is don't sell yourself short. You might accomplish amazing things. And way I've said it on your handout is it's amazing what 40 years of doing the right thing will do. I've had people walk in and say, well, here's where I'm at on my retirement nest egg. And I'm going, this is incredible. I don't know how you did this. I mean, how in the world did you manage to put aside any savings in the ministry setting you were in? And yet here they are, you know, and their home is paid for. And here they have a really nice retirement nest egg. So don't underestimate yourself. You can do more than you think over a lifetime of doing the right thing. Okay, well, let's dive back in here. If you see on your handout here, we want to get back to kind of where we started. Remember, we started at the very beginning saying that there are 2 roles here, and you would almost think, I say this jokingly, you would almost think there's a deceiver out there trying to reverse these roles. And, of course, there is a deceiver out there, you know, and we have our heart that does this to us as well, trying to always reverse these roles. But the roles are these. There is an owner role that is occupied by God. And so what is the owner role? The owner role is responsible for the results. If we have another downturn in the market and we lose half of everything we own, that's the owner's problem, not our problem. Okay, now that's hard to remember. I know what it means to get those statements and look at that account balance going down. I know that's hard to remember. It really does require us to trust that the owner is going to do the right thing, that he knows what he's doing. It really requires our trust. 1 Chronicles 29:14, we started our whole summer series with this verse. For all things come from you, and from your hand we have given you. So God owns everything. We know that. Psalm 24:1, the earth is the Lord's and all it contains, the world and those who dwell in it. And, of course, there are dozens of other verses we could use to support that statement that we know God owns it all. Then, as our series indicates, we're managing God's money. So what's a manager role or a steward role? What is that role? Our role is to be faithful. Now, again, it's just funny how human nature works. You know, we have something like we had in 08 and 09, and very few of us are sitting there questioning our faithfulness. We're sitting there fretting over the result. You know, we don't fret enough about, did I really get counsel? Was I smart in the way I did this? Did I let greed get in the way? Did I react in fear somehow? In other words, did I get off base a little bit in my faithfulness? And we don't think enough about that, and we think far too much about, oh, look at the result, you know, and we're wringing our hands, and we're worried about the result. So what does 1 Corinthians 4:2 tell us? It's required of stewards that one be found trustworthy. And we had that big word we used, remember that big MBA word we used called being a fiduciary, taking care of somebody else's money for their benefit, not for our benefit. And then Psalm 27, 23, and 24, be thou diligent. This is going to require effort and discipline on our part. Be thou diligent to know the state of thy flocks. Look well to thy herds, for riches are not forever, and doth the crown endure to every generation. So there is a fleeting nature to this. Remember we talked last week that they take wings and fly away, you know, riches do. So there's a fleeting nature to it, and we have to be diligent to be a good manager. So that's part of our job. Well, I want to take you now to something that Dr. Berg has taught, and I know most of you have read this book, or maybe have a copy of it at home, Changed Into His Image. That book has been a tremendous, tremendous help to me, that series, that video series, a tremendous help. I've spent many, many hours with that material, and many, many of his little word pictures, you know, some of those little stories he creates to kind of advance his point, have been very vivid to me, and they've stuck in my mind and been a great benefit in my own life. But out of all the things that Dr. Bird shared, and you see this in the middle of your handout here, probably nothing was more helpful to me in all of that book than what he has in chapter 13. And you see the reference there in the middle of your page if you want to go back and look it up. But this encompasses chapter 13. It's about a 17-page section there at the end of that book. And he talks about three kinds of farmers. And this has been so vivid in my mind and so helpful to me and so instructive that I think as we look at financial principles, this is a great way to kind of wrap things up for us. So let's talk a little bit, and this is, again, all Mr. Berg's material, and I'm deferring to him and referring to that book here when we talk. But let's talk about three kinds of farmers that he referred to, and there are some verses that talk about these farmers. There's the gambling farmer, gambling meaning gambling on the outcome. In other words, a guy that says basically, I know I haven't done the right thing, but it'll all work out in the end. You know, and we teachers at BJU, and a lot of you are in that role, we have gambling students regularly. You know, they gamble. You know, like, I'm sure it'll work out and all this. And you know, anyway. So Proverbs 20, verse 4. The sluggard, the lazy farmer, does not plow after the autumn, so he begs during the harvest and has nothing. So that's your lazy farmer. Then there's a second pair of farmers, one called the controlling in Mr. Berg's lingo, and another called the trusting farmer. These two people have a lot of similar characteristics. If you looked at them, these are the verses that would come to your mind. If you observed a controlling or a trusting farmer, here's what you might be thinking. Proverbs 10:4, the hand of the diligent makes rich. These are hardworking people. The soul of the diligent is made fat, and the hand of the diligent will rule. And when we say will rule, that means these are the people that serve on your committees at church. These are people that become deacons and Sunday school teachers. These are diligent, disciplined, high-character people. Okay, these are quality, hardworking people. But there is a subtle difference in those last two categories, and that's what we want to hone in on here just a little bit today. So let's look a little more deeply, if you look at your handout. Let's go a little more deep into these three farmers. The gambling and lazy farmer, and again, we see a few of these students occasionally. I'm very lucky. I have some of my former students here. I teach in the world of accounting, and so most accounting majors are not lazy students. We have a much lower share of those folks. If they choose a major like accounting, they've chosen a very hard major, and it's a very difficult road, and so we don't have this as much. But here's what the gambling or lazy farmer looks like. And you see in your handout there, he pleases himself by ignoring the laws of nature and gambling on the outcome. And so he's always looking for a second chance, okay? And we need to examine ourselves. I mean, does this sound like me in certain areas of life? Am I looking for a second chance? Is a person who is experiencing the reproofs of life. And unfortunately, some of us have seen this, maybe in our extended family, maybe we see it in our children, where you say, well, they did not receive the reproof of instruction. You know, I tried to give them good instruction, and I tried to give them a book, or I tried to give them the Ramsey series, or whatever it is, you know, in the area of finance. And you say, there's nothing more I can do. Life will have to teach them the remaining lessons. And if you're a parent, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And it's a fearful thing as a parent, because we know that life is not going to be as gentle with them as we would have been, you know. And so we fear for life giving them the reproofs instead of receiving, as Proverbs tells us, the reproofs of instruction. These people, if you had to boil it down to one word, here's your word you'd want to find with a gambling farmer: filled with excuses. These are all the reasons why I can't save properly. These are all the reasons why I can't do the bookkeeping properly. These are the reasons I'll never be able to pay my house off early. You know, they're just filled with excuses. You know, we talk in another part of Proverbs, you know, the sluggard is wiser than seven men can render a reason. I love that. You know, seven men can't out-talk this person. You know, they're so committed to their point of view. So that's the gambling farmer. What about the controlling farmer? He also pleases himself. And this is a quote from the book, and I can't say it any better than the book does. He does what's right in his own eyes in order to ensure and control the outcome that he has decided that he must have. So these kind of people always fear failure. They believe they're defining what's right. They must maintain control. This is really big to these people. This is a huge deal. They must maintain control. They fear failure, and here's the word you can always use with these folks. They are intense. They are intense. They're disciplined. They're hardworking, very goal-oriented, but boy, they're intense. And if you cross them, you'll feel it. You know, you'll sense it, and you'll really feel that intensity, and that'll be a signal that you might have a controlling farmer. Now, these two categories, very subtle, hard to tell the difference. Now, trusting farmer, what about this guy? Pleases God by wanting to have the fruit of the Spirit in his responses no matter what result the Father gives. So to me, again, this really goes back to that manager or steward role, that he delights in pleasing the Father by his hard work. In other words, he realizes that his job is to reflect upon the reputation of the master. His focus is on his responses. This is another characteristic of this guy that's different from the other one is, they're doing a lot of the same things, but in his heart, he is a peace-filled worker. So he's doing a lot of the same hard work. You know, if it was a field, he's still out there hoeing and sowing, and he's out there pulling weeds, and he's fertilizing and irrigating, but he's doing it with a peace-filled heart. So on the outside, it would be very difficult to tell the difference between these two folks. So let's keep talking about them a little bit. So you say, well, when somebody like Pastor Greg comes along and says we ought to do a summer series about finances, I know some of you are thinking, well, I'm sure what he's wanting to do is to motivate some lazy farmers to get busy. And that is a motivation. I hope we've done that this summer in terms of inspiring you and trying to encourage you to do the right thing. You know, try not to fuss at you, you know, because I know this is not a fun topic and all that. But we are trying to help you get busy. We do want you to do better record keeping. You know, be more conscious of expenses. Pay debt. Do save for retirement. We really do want to emphasize that we do need to get busy. That is definitely a part of what we're trying to do. But a bigger part of my concern and from my own personal life is I'm not so much the lazy farmer. My problem is I'm the controlling farmer. Unfortunately, I'm quite a veteran controlling farmer. I've lived many, many years of my life as a controlling farmer. And those folks really want to ensure a certain outcome. They believe, and you have to really talk to yourself and really get to the bottom of this if this is in your heart, because it's not the easiest thing to find. They really believe there's a deal working here, that I'm going to do X and then I'm going to get Y. In other words, if I delay my gratification in my 20s, then I'm going to get my gratification in my 60s. In other words, I mean, there's a deal. There's a sense in which if I do the right thing, I'm owed a certain outcome. And you have to really be honest with yourself to find that in your heart. And I've certainly found it in mine many, many, many times. So let's keep talking about these guys as you go down your handout. I want you to be very, very careful as you read financial advice, and it has never been more prevalent. There is financial advice everywhere. You know, I'm a reader of the Wall Street Journal, so certainly you're going to find it there, but it's far beyond that. It's on the radio. There's any number of personalities you can listen to. It's on websites, blogs. Everywhere you go, there's financial advice. But here's the danger with some of that advice, and it's very hard to spot it. if you're at BJU as a student, we talk about this being your worldview. That's your key, and it's not always easy to spot it. Watch for a man-centered worldview. And you say, Jeff, what in the world are you talking about? The problem with a lot of financial advice is very simple. They want you to manage your money well, and the pitch, basically, of almost every financial book is very simple. If you'll manage your money better, it'll be better for you in the long run, right? If you'll manage money well in your 20s, you can live better in your 60s. And if you'll go counter to the world, you'll end up in a better spot than the world. And to some degree, that's not entirely wrong. In other words, sound principles really are fine. If you look at your handout there, these are good principles. It is good to control impulse spending. It is, you know, true that debt leads to bondage. It is better to pay for a car with cash. I mean, they're teaching you sound principles. I'm not arguing with the soundness of the principles. Those are good and sound and right. But the question is, we have to watch our motives. In other words, here's the phrase. If you live like no one else today, what if you don't get to live like no one else later? You follow? In other words, what if you do the right thing in your 20s and God somehow takes it away from you in your 60s? Are you going to be angry with that result? If that were to happen, would God still be good? That's a tough one, isn't it? I mean, that's tough because, you know, so much of what we do, again, I just think there's this inherent deal there like, wait a minute, my turn to be able to have enjoyment and gratification was supposed to happen in my 50s. What if I have a health issue? What if I lose my spouse and my turn never comes? Are you going to be angry if that happens? Are you going to be bitter? If you are, then that's a dangerous sign because that may be a sign that you have a controlling heart. So looking down at the bottom down here, I think there's two ways to try to tell the difference, even about ourselves. Remember, our heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. So the first person we need to examine is our own heart, our own self. And here's, I think, how, and Mr. Berg refers to this in the book, the way you can tell the difference between a controlling farmer and a trusting farmer is what happens when a week before the harvest, if a hailstorm comes along and destroys the crop. That's when the two farmers are revealed. The controlling farmer will be angry and bitter because he has lost control, the deal has been broken, and he'll be very, very frustrated by that event. The trusting farmer will say, I assume God has another plan for how he's going to take care of my family. Everything is fine. I know I was faithful. I'm not worried about the outcome. That's the responsibility of an owner, and my job is to reflect well upon him, respond well. I'm not worried at all. Now, I'll tell you something, that's hard to do. I mean, I'm just going to tell you, that is hard to do. If you have an 08 or 09 financial crisis, you know, the year you're going to retire and you lose half of your nest egg, that is going to take some real Holy Spirit grace to respond as a trusting farmer, okay? I'm not diminishing how hard that would be from a human point of view. That would be very hard. So the other way you can tell this guy, and this you got to really be honest with yourself about your heart. A lot of us controlling farmers, we look across the street, so to speak, or we look at someone else in our family and say, well, look how they're mismanaging their money. They're living large, you know, they're not working on their home. They've got that second home. They've got the boat, whatever it might be. They're living too large, and there's going to be a price to pay one of these days. And, you know, you go all the way through life, and then all of a sudden you get to retirement age, and some unexpected event happens to them, maybe an inheritance, maybe the government bails them out, and suddenly they're living as well as we are in retirement, and they apparently never suffered the consequences for all of their laziness. If you're honest with yourself, you'd say, you know what, I don't like that. That doesn't feel right to me. I'm not happy for them. I'm not happy that the Lord took care of them, you know. And again, it might be an indication that we're a controlling farmer. So to me, this is very convicting material. It's Dr. Berg's material, and it's very, very convicting for me. Okay? So as we flip the page then, what can we do to really determine if we're a trusting farmer? How could we know whether we're a trusting farmer? Here's some things that we should identify about ourselves if we're going to become a trusting farmer. First of all, we're always concerned and aware of our responses. That is our driving characteristic, is that we're always aware that we represent someone else, that we're here to reflect well upon his reputation, and to bring glory to that other person. So our response is everything. Now, again, Is that the first thing I think of when I wake up in the morning? No, it isn't. I mean, that's a learned thing. That's a grace-filled, grace-required thing, you know, to become that kind of person. He wants to reflect well, and he doesn't require a certain outcome. He doesn't have to have a deal, right? If he delays gratification in his 20s, and then his gratification never happens in his 50s or 60s, he's never upset about that. Now, that takes some real growth to get there, I'll tell you. That's a hard one, and that takes a lot of growth. So again, I'm learning this with you. I'm convicted by it, and very, very sobering information for me. Let me tell you a quick example. Look in the middle of your back page there. Did you know that the Bible has already given us an example of a person who went through a financial apocalypse on the day that he was getting ready to retire? And you say, now, Jeff, that is a stretch. The Bible doesn't use the word retirement. You are really stretching on this one. It's not as much of a stretch as you think. Think back with me to the story of Jacob. I know you know the story very, very well. You may just not have looked at it through this prism, right? I'm a financial guy, so when I read the Bible, and I read, as we did in our sermon a couple of weeks ago, when I hear about the Ethiopian eunuch, I think of, wow, he was the CFO of that country, right? Joseph was the CFO of Egypt. You know, I think like that because I'm a finance guy. This is what I do, right? And so as I read about Jacob, what we find is that he faced retirement, if I could call it that, at the age of 130. At the age of 130, we know later that he died at age 147, so he died 17 years later. As he faced retirement, he faced a worldwide financial collapse, right? 7 years of famine. Nobody saw it coming. And what happened to him in that famine? He lost a lot, by the way. Don't forget this. I don't know how many thousands of acres he owned there in what we would now call the land of Palestine. I don't know how many thousands of acres he had, but he lost them all, didn't he? He lost all of his real estate. How many barns do you think he had? How many stables? How big was his ranch house and all of his 11 children's homes on that estate? That would have been quite an estate, don't you think? Quite a big real estate investment. He had probably dozens, maybe more hundreds, I don't know, of servants that maybe had been born in his home. That was how you measured your wealth back in those days. He lost all of his real estate, all of his servants. He lost all of his wealth that couldn't travel by foot, right? So part of their wealth was denominated in their flocks and herds, and he did get to hang on to that. And he got his, what was it, you know, the Bible counts him up for us, you know, what was it, 75 or 66, I forget the number, of his immediate family, basically, that was saved, including the four of Joseph's family down in Egypt. And so basically he got out of there with his children and his flocks and herds, but otherwise he was wiped out. He had a financial collapse at his retirement age. He was completely wiped out. Now here's my question. Did he have a good retirement? Do you think Jacob was okay with the retirement he had? I'd say he was pretty happy, don't you? He got to get taken to the land of Egypt. He got reunited with a son that he thought was long since dead. Found out his son's the second most powerful man in the world. He was put in the most lush part of Egypt, the land of Goshen. We said that was the choicest land, so really the choicest land in all of the world. He's reunited with his family, surrounded by his family for a 17-year retirement that could not have been planned by him. It had nothing to do with his nest egg, which was back in the land of Israel, right? Back in that land, completely, you know, going to waste. And yet he was blessed by God. He had a wonderful, wonderful retirement. And I find a lot of encouragement in that. Now, unfortunately, Jacob, when he gets in front of Pharaoh, he doesn't acquit himself very well. When Pharaoh says, well, how's it going? He says, oh, few and evil have been the years of my life. And he doesn't really reflect a real trusting heart, unfortunately, like I probably would have done. You know, he doesn't really sing God's praises like you would think he would. But he did have a great retirement, even though he faced a financial collapse at that time. So I find a lot of encouragement in that, and I don't think we're stretching the story too far to apply it that way. All right, let me close with this. If you have your handout, these are two quotes that I want to share with two or three that I think are really really good, and I'll take them kind of one at a time. This one's been quoted by many people. I don't have a source for it. But sadly, most people spend more time planning their vacation than planning for retirement or their financial goals. And so, again, kind of sad to think, you know, kind of that lazy farmer type mentality. Now, here's another quote by a guy named John Piper. I know this guy's a little controversial. Remember, I'm an accounting major, so I'm not giving you any thoughts on his theology or his doctrine or anything like that, but I do like this particular quote. The issue is not how much a person makes. The evil is in being deceived into thinking that a $100,000 salary must be accompanied by a $100,000 lifestyle. God has made us to be conduits of his grace. The danger is in thinking that the conduit should be lined with gold. it shouldn't. Copper will do. Pretty good quote, pretty good one. And then, of course, you know that my favorite guy throughout the summer has been this guy, Randy Alcorn. And again, I would encourage you to get this book and read it. It's a tremendous book. Here's his final quote, and then we'll open it up for any questions you might have. Do we really believe we'll stand before Christ's judgment seat and hear him say, I have this against you. You gave too much. You should have kept more for yourself and your family. Jesus never called someone a fool for giving too much and keeping too little. But in the parable about the rich man, he did call someone a fool for keeping too much and giving too little. So a pretty sobering quote there. I really like that. Then one final thing, as Pastor Greg comes, I do have a gift for you if you'd like to have it. It's somebody was with me the other day, and we mentioned that two or three times I've told you should have what we call an in case of death file. Basically, your first step in estate planning is to gather all of your records in one place. And I really encourage you to do that. I did it maybe, I don't know, went 10, 12 years ago. It has been a great help to me personally. And so some of you said, well, wait a minute, what should be in that file? Well, I've got a checklist that I'll email to you if you send me an email, and I can give it to you in two forms. One, if you're a paper type person, I'll give it to you in a PDF form that you can simply print it and fill it out, you know, as you see fit. Or I'll also give it to you in an Excel format if you want to edit the thing, add lines to it, take lines away. I'd be happy to do that. You have my email there at the bottom. I'd be happy to send that little gift to you. And hopefully that'll help motivate you to get that little in case of death file together for yourself. Okay, so we can have some questions.
All right. Thank you, Jeff, for being willing to do that. I know when Nancy and I left for Turkey, one of the last things we did with the kids was pointed out where there's an envelope.
You got it.
That basically had in case of death with all of our final things in it that would be helpful for them to know. So appreciate that. Why don't we look at that last page, kind of a nice overview of the whole summer financial management checklist, just a review there. And that I know we've covered so much material that as you kind of just go through that, this is your last opportunity to ask Jeff a question maybe about those 16 points, maybe elaboration or just something that maybe would be helpful for all of us to listen to. Any questions? Again, just to kind of get some thoughts going on that last page, financial management checklist. Any questions related to the things here? Harriet has one. Jeff.
Gotcha. Yeah, her question for the recording is, if you were to get an inheritance, kind of an unexpected windfall, how would you use it? And again, I think the checklist, to me, that is kind of what's helpful. And even Ramsey, what I do like about what he's done with that seven-step deal and the reason I've added it, I know he's tried to condense a lot of material down to six or seven things people can kind of wrap their arms around. But I really would, and I think he would tell you this, if you get an unexpected windfall, I would ask myself, where am I, like on his seven steps, like am I... Now, what he does, I didn't put the asterisk on there, but he would tell you to do step 4, 5, and 6 simultaneously. So, like, for example, if you say, well, if I got an unexpected windfall, you know, how am I doing on preparing for my kids' college? How am I doing on paying off my house? How am I doing on getting a retirement nest egg? Those are all three really good things. And he tells you to do them simultaneously. So, you know, like my wife and I, when we got to that stage of the game, we would take half of any extra money we had, put half of it toward retirement savings and half of it toward the house because they were both such good goals and the time value of money was at work in both. Like we wanted our retirement nest egg to build on the time value of money, but we knew that we were paying interest as well, so we just couldn't decide which was better, so we did it half and half. And so that's what I would do if I got an... I would find myself on the checklist to say, what's the next thing ahead of me that maybe I'm behind on or whatever and try to use it wisely. And that does happen occasionally. It really does. People get unexpected windfalls. Any others? Any others there? A couple of tax tips. I think early in the seminar, Dr. Guthrie asked a question about taking required minimum distributions out of your IRA and how frustrating that is that people, you know, have to do that when they don't really need the money. It's like you have to unwind your IRA and pay tax on it even if you don't need it. Well, I think you and I chatted about that one time, that one way you can create some good out of that in one of those rules that renew every year, and we need to watch and see if it does, is to do some of your giving out of the IRA and send the money directly, like to your church or whatever, directly out of the IRA and not have to pay the tax on that portion of your IRA money. So that's a nice
nice outlet there to be able to do some giving out of your IRA if you're having to take RMDs and you would really rather not have to do that. Now, again, that's one of those rules. They have to renew it each year, so you'd want to pay attention and see if that did get renewed. Other ideas? Questions? Yes. If somebody has been foolish in managing their money is the question, what do I say to them? Well, to be honest, what I do, I keep in PDF form on my computer, both at work and at home. I have it really near at hand. I pull out two of the Larry Burkett worksheets, and I usually send it to them in an email and say, here's what I need you to do. I need you to fill out this little worksheet of all of your spending. And I'm doing that for a couple of reasons. One is I want them to do a little work before we get together, and I want to find out how good are they at understanding what their spending is. Do they remember to put car insurance on there? Do they remember to put their home mortgage insurance, whatever? So I try to get a snapshot of where they are in life, and then I use that second sheet where he kind of shows you what a family that's not in debt looks like. I kind of use that to teach them and say, all right, let's get a snapshot of where you are right now, and are you $200 behind each month? Then that's one kind of advice. If you're $2,000 behind on each month, then that's a different kind of advice. You know, that's a home problem or a car problem. So that's kind of what I do, is I diagnose kind of where they are and then sit down and chat with them and then kind of go from there. You know, you have to kind of diagnose and then prescribe is the ideal. So, do I lend them money? Well, you know, there have been times that I have anonymously been touched by somebody's need and I've tried to help them anonymously. I'll tell you, my wife and I, this thing of giving money away is quite tricky because just like when the government gives money away, even with your own children, you can create a dependency. And I'm trying to get gold, silver, and precious stones, so I don't really want my giving known. You know, I'm trying to make it anonymous. So we have tried to strategically help people anonymously, but it is tricky. It's tricky because our human nature is so quick to expect it. It's so quick to take that and then need more. The other thing I try to do is get them in front of a benevolence committee that I hope has an accountability mechanism. In other words, a benevolence committee ought to have a mechanism of, you know, a guy like me or somebody going through their finances and holding them accountable for things. And that's another danger of giving money away without the accountability is, you know, are you perpetuating the problem instead of fixing it? So this idea of giving money away is quite tricky, more than you might think. Because you can do harm with it. I've said before, money's like carrying around acid, you know, in a container. You have to be so careful, it'll just corrupt everything it touches. It's so concerning. Other thoughts?
We're almost wrapped up. Last question maybe for the day. If you're thinking about one, again, not that just because Dave Ramsey says it makes it right, but those of you that are familiar with Dave Ramsey's material would say that he would never loan money to anyone. He either gives it, no strings attached, or he doesn't give.
Yeah.
And again, that doesn't mean that that's the gospel answer. That's just what Dave Ramsey would teach. You either give it, or if you don't want to give it, just let it go, but not loan.